Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'll be talking with Malik Gotcham about his recent book, The Old Regime and the Haitian Revolution. Malik, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much, Dan, for having me. It's a delight.
So your book looks at the long legal history around slavery in the French Caribbean colony of Saint-Domingue, up to that colony's revolution, which is ultimately successful and creates the modern state of Haiti. I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about how you came to this project, especially because you have a legal background yourself. And so what were the origins of this study?
I started it when I was a graduate student at Stanford. And at the time, I thought I was going to study the French Revolution in old regime France. And I think what first attracted me to the subject was that I wanted to study what I thought was an aspect at the time of the French Revolution that hadn't yet been the subject of a great deal of scholarship. That's to say, I wanted to kind of look to see where the French Revolution traveled and find some sort of hidden, unexplored corner. And Saint-Domingue wasn't entirely unexplored at the time. There had been a few works, but very little. This is the early 90s, I would say, when I first really began getting interested in this. And since then, there's been this huge explosion of work, and it's really become a subject in its own right. And so I no longer think about it in the way that I did when I first got interested in the subject, which is to say as a sort of margin of the French Revolution. I think of it now as a subject in its own right. And a lot of my thinking about the subject really kind of evolved from a kind of center-periphery framework to one that sort of took Saint-Domingue and the Haitian Revolution as sort of entities, localities, problems in their own right. And I think that's the basic orientation now of Haitian and of Haitian revolutionary studies. But so I would say there was a bit of a romantic kind of inspiration at the very beginning, in the sense of kind of unpacking this unexplored corner of the French Revolution. And you know, it's interesting to trace the scholarship on the subject. It is sort of treated in some of the early works as, you know, here's another chapter of the French Revolution that you should know about, versus today, as I was saying earlier, here's a subject in its own right. And it really does now constitute a really blossoming field of Caribbean history.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's interesting is that you combine both this French legal perspective with the colonial legal perspective and also just the generalities around slavery. And that might be a good place to start off. You really describe kind of the tensions in keeping a slave society going, especially one like Saint-Domingue, which in the 18th century is the most profitable slave society in the world, has perhaps the largest enslaved population in the world. So what are the central tensions in keeping that society just running effectively from a kind of economic standpoint?
Well, I mean, the legal orientation to this was just to circle back for a moment, Dan, to your first question, was also part of my initiation into the field, because it was the figure Moreau de Saint-Méry, who's a key figure in this area, who had compiled the first major archive of Saint-Domingue, and that became integrated into the French colonial archives, who was the person who kind of got me going on the subject. And I started working through his collections of primary documents and some of his own writings about Saint-Domingue. And it's through those documents that, as you say, I began to understand what some of the kind of the underlying dynamics of this slave society were. And the two that I'm most interested in, although it really is a selection of two among several dynamics that one could focus on, were manumission and planter brutality. Because it was these that seemed to trigger an enormous degree of interest on the part of administrators, and therefore one presumes also on the part of the planters who are governed by these administrators, in terms of how you handle a society that was so racially, if you will, imbalanced. Use the word imbalanced, you know, with a grain of salt there, but really a society in which the Côte Noire was developed at a time when there weren't many more slaves than there were whites and free people of color, eventually comes to govern a society in which the disproportion between whites and slaves is enormous, you know, roughly 30,000 to 500,000 by the end of the old regime. And so the Côte Noire has a notion that these two issues, manumission and the disciplining of slaves, are going to be things to keep an eye on if you're an administrator sort of overseeing this whole operation, because there are articles that address these questions, torture, under what conditions can a planter free his slave. And really the story of the Côte Noire is in a sense it's about overcoming in the sense of understanding that a single legislation, 1685, is not going to be sufficient in order to address all of the issues that are going to crop up over the course of the century. And so the Côte Noire gets supplemented, it gets revised, modified. There are lots of individual judicial decisions and regulations that kind of get added to it over the course of the 18th century so that it becomes the document that, you know, we know today as the Côte Noire. Or that, as it was understood in the 18th century, the general law of slavery of the French Empire. But those are some of the key issues that pop up, and the book is really trying to take those two themes and trace their development until the moment at which they become sort of centerpieces of the revolutionary crisis in 1789 through the 1790s.
Well, it might be a good place to get into some of the details here around the Côte Noire, and I apologize, there's a leaf blowing going on outside my door. So if it's a little bit loud, that's because of that. So just describe the intentions of the Côte Noire. It's obviously a pretty central piece of legislation for Saint-Domingue and the French Empire. You don't deal with it this book, but it really has a lot of influence on many slave regimes in the Americas. But what were the intentions of the Côte Noire? Kind of how did it come to pass? And then we can kind of get into what its legacy was over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's actually a good deal of literature on this by now. Vernon Palmer, who's a legal historian at Tulane, has written about the origins of the Côte Noire. It turns out that we have the legislative history of the document to look at. It's in the archives in Aix-en-Provence. And so one of the long fights over this is whether or not it was essentially Roman law based, or did it embody sort of local customs in the Caribbean that had sprung up in Martinique and other French colonies over the second half of the 17th century, and I talk a bit about that debate in the book. But I'm less interested in sort of the kind of strictly legal origins of the Côte Noire than in again kind of understanding sort of what is the ethos of the society that it's trying to govern. And there you can see, just in terms of the law itself, that there's a set of articles that come out of this legislative preparation that are trying to address excessive battering of slaves by planters. And they specifically note the fear that unless this is clamped down on, you're going to get something like a slave revolt happening in these rising Caribbean societies. And so there's this at once a kind of aversionary worry about, you know, what to do if planters are left alone. But it's combined with an awareness that Saint-Domingue is kind of this rising slave society, and that it needs a law that will permit it to expand commercially and sort of reach its full potential. And so this notion of the accroissement, the potential for the increase of this colony, is there from the very beginning, and it's really connected to how people think about the law, because they, as I say, they want a law that will permit commercial expansion. And the idea that is, in order to permit this process, you have to govern the individuals who are kind of at the grassroots of the whole production process. So planters, slaves, free people of color, but also overseers, and many other characters who are involved in this process. And a similar kind of thing, can be told with respect to manumission. There are a series of articles that look at how, if you permit a private planter to free his slave without any restriction, what's that going to do to the racial dynamics and balances within the colony? And really, after the Code Noir is implemented in 1685. That concern takes center stage for like maybe the first 20, 30 years of Saint-Domingue under royal control. So by the early 18th century, there's a realization that that aspect of the Code Noir has to change. And indeed, they do change it. I think in 1713, they adopt a new ordinance on manumission that makes it much more difficult to do. It's not just a sort of free option for planters. So, I think that there are some sort of internal legal dynamics that are at work here, but I think from the very beginning, the jurists who were in charge of this process and the administrators really were thinking about law in terms of a commercial project. And it's hard to say that one is sort of driving the other. I mean, they're sort of feeding back into each other at every moment. But I do think that it's important to really grasp this aspiration for colonial greatness and expansion that you see in late 17th, early 18th century Saint-Domingue, and that kind of reflects the geopolitical rivalries in the Caribbean. So there are the British colonies, there are the Dutch colonies, there's Spanish America, and France really I think sees an opportunity in Saint-Domingue for a real rival to these other, in some cases, older imperial powers, and the law of slavery gets kind of co-opted into those rivalries and those ways of thinking about how to produce a successful colonial venture.
So, to get back to that point you made at the beginning about this tension between manumission and brutality that's really central to the Code Noir. One of the things that kind of made me think was, could you say that the plantation was not really a site of total absolutism or autocracy in Saint-Domingue? I mean, one of the things that stands out is that there's this real tension between the planters who want to exert as much control as they can over their enslaved people versus administrators that want to see, again, just the commercial operations continue without too many problems. They don't want to see maybe an overly large free population of color that could complicate that. They don't want to see enslaved rebels that are going to rise up because it's just too brutal. So how much autocracy does a planter have?
It's a hard question to answer. Effectively, as a matter of day-to-day social control over the slave populations of a particular plantation, pretty much close to total. Very little sense in which the royal administration could kind of insert itself into an individual plantation and actually prevent a master from doing A, B, or C to one of his slaves. So as a matter of day-to-day plantation governance, the Code Noir really is a dead letter. But there's a difference between saying that and saying that the Code Noir is a dead letter in general. In other words, there's another level of colonial administration that is going on alongside of the day-to-day management of the plantations, and that's the level that you actually see reflected in the colonial records. And what it really is a reflection on the first problem. That's to say, the inability to insert sort of royal administration into the plantations, and colonial law is reflecting that inability. There are only a few cases over the course of the 18th century where a planter will actually get drawn before a colonial official and called to answer for his or her treatment of a slave. But I think it's those instances that again, sort of reveal what the administrative ethos and what the problems of governing this colony are. So I think one has to distinguish between what is actually happening on the plantations and what the law is aspiring to do, but not in order to say that one of these matters and the other doesn't, but in order to understand what their relationship is. Because I think, you know, the law clearly does matter. I mean, it is a mandate that the colonial officials are given to enforce. And when they develop policies for the colony as a whole, they are drawing upon and trying to enforce that mandate. So I think that's one way of thinking about the problem. Another way of thinking about it is to say that administrators were also planters themselves, at least until early in the 18th century. I mean, there's a regulation passed, I think, in the early 1720s that prohibits administrators from owning plantations themselves. And, you know, that's another one of these laws that was sort of more respected in the breach of it. So, you know, planters are not... planters and administrators are not a mutually exclusive group. They're quite related to one another. In some cases, they are the same people, and therefore, it's not surprising to see that the way that these administrators think in terms of a kind of strategic governance of slavery is also, in some sense, the way that some planters, at least, think about the administration of slavery themselves. And so, you know, at certain moments, in particular this 1788 Lejeune case that I write about, you can see that the planters themselves, the quote-unquote kingpins of the plantation order, are themselves seeking to enforce a version of this Code Noir vision of slavery in which the planter cannot be, as you put it, an absolute authority, but has to kind of participate in the collective action problem here. And the collective action problem is if everybody does what he or she wants to do on their own, it's going to cause problems for the plantation order as a whole. And this is sort of economics lingo, but I think there's a version of this going on in the law of slavery in Saint-Domingue. And it creates some kind of difficult, it creates some paradoxical incentives and reactions on the part of those involved in the whole process.
Well, and that might be a good place to talk about the Lejeune case. So you discuss Nicolas Lejeune, who he comes up on trial for being overly brutal towards his enslaved workers and right on the eve of the revolution. And so could you just say a little bit about sort of how that case comes to trial and sort of how it connects to this idea about a regulatory process over brutality?
Yeah, the Lejeune case, 1788, is the prosecution of a master for the torture of, initially for the torture of two female slaves, and then it turns out that there were a whole series of other abuses going on at this plantation that preceded the particular owner in question. But finally, in 1788, the Conseil Supérieur see an opportunity to kind of clamp down on this problem. It's not an accident that this comes in 1788 at a time when there are administrative proposals for the reform of slavery. The abolitionist movement is just getting off in France and Britain and elsewhere. The French monarchy itself is at a time of potentially seismic reform. Largely as a result of these two women slaves who escape from their plantation and take up a provision of the Code Noir that permits them to bring a complaint to a court official against their master, they succeed in having a complaint issued, and a prosecution commences of Nicolas Lejeune for the torture of a number of slaves on his plantation. And the story of the case is not so much the legal prosecution itself, but how the planters react to the prosecution once initiated. And then, you know, it's kind of an interesting legal tussle, though, so far as I'm aware, no actual lawyers are involved, but the planters act as their own lawyers. And the defendant makes the kinds of arguments about the Code Noir that had been made, you know, since the early 18th century, namely, if you permit slaves to assert claims against their masters, you're going to produce an anarchic society in which property relations no longer govern. And then on the other hand, an argument made by other planters in a brief that they submit to the court is that these particular masters, the Lejeune, have been causing trouble for all of us, and it's about time that something be done about it. And so, you know, right there you see again that divide that I was talking about within the planter community. It's a fascinating case, about 60 manuscript pages in the French colonial archives, and the arguments kind of go back and forth. Eventually, he is convicted at the trial court level, and then on appeal, it looks like at the very last minute, thanks to the intervention of either the planter himself or somebody very friendly to this particular defendant, they get one of the decisive votes on the Supreme Court in Saint-Domingue to switch his vote. So I think 3-4, it wasn't 4-3, the decision is made not to pursue the prosecution any further. And the case more or less ends there, with the defendant having fled as a fugitive from justice, in effect. And I use it just to kind of unpack the nature of the state of the Côte Noir at the very end of the old regime, about a year before the French Revolution begins to undo the long established practices for interpreting the Côte Noir.
Well, and the case really gets that idea that there's some attempt at regulation, or that there's certainly an anger on the part of many planters that this would be an incursion on their domain on the plantation. And then the other side of that is this issue of manumission, which you sort of cover earlier in the book. And manumission is also kind of a tense side of exchange, both between planters and also colonial and imperial officials as well. And so could you describe how manumission becomes this flashpoint for the debate around how slavery is supposed to run and what the colony is supposed to look like?
Yeah, that's a good question, Dan. I mean, there's a parallel here between planter brutality, which has this double edge. Planter brutality, on the one hand, is necessary to impose discipline. On the other hand, it creates the potential for subversion. And I think that manumission really has a similar double edge to it. On the one hand, it is a way of, as Orlando Patterson has put it, of kind of relieving pressure it's a release valve on the slave society. It's an incentive for slaves to conform themselves to the day-to-day rules that govern a particular plantation, with the hope that they'll be rewarded with their freedom at the end of the day, or in the Spanish context, with the hope that they can buy their freedom, because freedom was available for purchase under the Spanish law of slavery, but not under the French or British laws of slavery. So there is a positive incentive, but then there is also a negative threat that is associated with manumission, and that threat is that if you free too many of these slaves, you have a community of free people who are in close proximity with their enslaved brethren, and I think that's the key. Now, the assumption is that the freed person remains attached to the enslaved community, whereas we know in the case of Saint-Domingue that many free people of color went on themselves to become slave owners, particularly in the South, where they owned and managed coffee and indigo plantations, as John Garrigus has shown in his book Before Haiti. There's a complicated I think manumission gives rise to a number of complicated social dynamics, but the key one is this idea that you need it on the one hand, because if everybody is a slave, then nobody has an incentive to remain a slave. And on the other hand, you can't use too much of it, because an overly robust population of freed slaves is itself a bad example to set for the enslaved community. And you can see how that worry plays itself out in all kinds of ways, from regulations that are designed to prevent free people of color from communing in the taverns of colony towns and drinking and gambling and playing cards and so on late into the night. So the free people of color carry a double burden. They carry the burden of not being entirely free, because even though freed from slavery, they are prohibited from engaging in the full range of activities that whites, whether poor or rich, are able to pursue in Saint-Domingue. but they are also under this burden of having, in a sense, to answer for the problems of a slave society in which discipline is inevitable, in which you have this constant tension, this constant anxiety about whether or not the slave revolt is going eventually to unfold. And I would say that as I was reading over the documents while doing the research for the book, that seemed to me to be, in a sense, the central problem. If you will, it's the Haitian Revolution before the Haitian Revolution. It is not an actual revolt. There are actually very few slave revolts in a sort of, if you sort of take an empirical approach to this and you look for actual slave revolts in Saint-Domingue, I think you find 3, 4, or 5 of them over the course of the 18th century, and David Gagas has tracked those. But the problem of the slave revolt before the Haitian Revolution is not actually an empirical problem. It's a problem that exists in the minds of everybody who governs the society, and also in the minds of the slaves and free people of color themselves, because they too are responding to a lot of these situations. So I guess one of the things the book was hoping to do was to show how this problem of the imagined slave revolt could actually be a major one in a time of slavery itself, that it is not simply a problem of the revolutionary era or of the age of emancipation. It's a problem of the age of slavery itself. And the book is designed to show the role of that problem as a problem for colonial administration, and as a result of the struggle that took place over it, therefore also a problem for the revolutionary process. And there we get into the latter part of the book, which I don't know if you want to enter into that now, but that is the other claim that's made here, is that these conflicts that unfold over the course of the colonial period, roughly 1685 to the 1780s, they don't just go away in 1789. The Code Noir is not repealed in 1789. It remains in force. And so what happens then in those early revolutionary years, needs to be understood as a story of a slave society that is gradually responding to a number of new influences, some of which coming from outside of the colony, some of which are coming from inside the colony, most notably the free people of color uprising in the north of Saint-Domingue, and the great slave uprisings of the early 1790s. Those events really change the debate over the Code Noir, and they make it radically different, but not unrecognizable. That is to say, you can still see that worries over how to discipline slaves and concerns about what manumission represents for the future of this slave colony. Those worries still shape how people are thinking in the early 1790s after the name of the game has been changed, so to speak, by these uprisings.
Well, yeah, and maybe this is a good chance to kind of get into the details of the revolution, but before that, I just want to maybe ask one more broad question about this. You're really trying to show that enslaved Dominicans had more connection to the law than we might previously have felt. And so maybe before we get into the actual details of the revolution itself, how much access did enslaved people have to the law? You note that even though there's this Code Noir, which is supposedly going to be out there to ostensibly improve the relationships between owners and slaves, that doesn't necessarily get employed in the frequency that you would expect or you would hope. But was there a chance for enslaved people to actually use the law to their benefit at all? Because I think that kind of ties into your sense that the law was central to how the insurgents thought about what this uprising initially was.
Yeah, there is, there's a great famous article by E.P. Thompson, The Moral Economy of the English Crowd. That scholars of slavery have I think been using in recent years to think about how slaves and other disenfranchised persons thought about law, about formal structures of governance, and I think that there's an entirely other book to write, Dan, along these lines here that is only suggested by my book, and I that's to say I think there are actually very few formal sort of legal invocations by slaves, and I think I found most of them, if not all of them. There may be a few more that are you know creeping around in the archives. And those incidents are important, but I think they are important because they point to this other way of engaging with the law that you might call a kind of moral economy of slavery approach. You know, you're relying on Thompson. And so what are some of the elements of that? A sense that the king stood for the slaves, wanted to protect the slaves. So you could call this royalism, but I like to think of it as a kind of code noir value, which is that the king stands with us. You see this with peasant uprisings in old regime Europe, England, France, everywhere. In the Caribbean, it's slaves. And why does he stand with us? Well, he stands with us because there's this document out there called the Code Noir, which, while slaves may not be able to cite it verse and chapter, they are generally aware that there are things that you're not supposed to do. And I think that's the awareness that you see kind of break out in some of the, in these rare instances where, in fact, slaves do invoke, you know, the provisions of the Code Noir that allow them to bring a complaint. But as I say, there would be a whole other book to write about this sort of informal engagement with slave law in the 18th century. Natalie Davis has written quite nicely about this in the case of Curaçao. And there's a lot of work kind of in the revolutionary era in the 19th century and beyond that talks about sort of vernacular understandings of the law of slavery. But I think it'd be really interesting to see what such a project would look like for, you know, one of the old regime slave colonies. And you know, I think that book is yet to be written. But I think that's probably the way to go. I think there's probably a limit to what you can do with the actual legal documents. I think probably this sort of study would have to rely more on plantation records than I used. And the plantation records are kind of dispersed, you know, sort of all over France and perhaps some in Haiti also. But they're in different private and local departmental collections in France. Records that are attached to particular plantations that would show, you know, probably through planter correspondence, how slaves may have been articulating, invoking, expressing this moral economy of slavery. Paul Cheney at the University of Chicago is working on a really interesting book that looks at, it's a micro history of a particular plantation in Cul-de-Sac in Saint-Domingue. And I think that's the kind of work that we'd really need to push the ball further in this area.
So how then, to get to the revolution itself, because you really are trying to paint a through line from the old regime to the Haitian Revolution. So in what ways is the Code Noir still invoked before and during the revolution by both free people of color who have their own little mini uprising and then also the enslaved insurgents?
Yeah, the documents are more articulate with respect to what the free people of color do than with respect to the slaves. But I think the basic story can be made out in both cases. Free people of color invoke Article 59 of the Code Noir to say that, as indeed it said, that once you free a slave, that person is entitled to the same immunities and franchises as a native-born subject of the king. That's an article, of course, that was never really enforced in Saint-Domingue at all during the colonial period. And so its importance becomes that of a way of shaming the National Assembly. At the beginning of the revolutionary era, into living up to a certain ideal. Now, it's shaming because the ideal was established not by the Revolutionary Assembly itself, but by this very old piece of legislation that was put out by Louis XIV in 1685. And so Julien Raymond is really quite brilliant in how he makes use of this. But he's brilliant for another reason also, I think, which is that it's really, I think, impossible to underestimate just how much condemnation was directed at the free people of color who began to demand the enforcement of these ideals in 1788, 89, 1790. And so, you know, thinking about how to articulate such a campaign, you know, you've got a couple of options. by this time. One, you can make a kind of natural rights-based argument, simply say, look, this is my God-given right, perhaps, or my human right, and I want you to enforce it. You can try to invoke the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen as of August 17, as of the promulgation of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. And there is some effort to invoke that document as well. But there is also, I wouldn't necessarily say more prominently, but certainly equally prominently, conspicuously, this reliance on the law of slavery. And it was part of the law of slavery. It's an original article of the Code Noir that is helping to drive this debate. So the point is that if you are going to innovate, and that's the term that was used to describe these folks who wanted to reform, to introduce changes into the system as of the revolution, you need an authority to rely on. There's only so many you can rely on, but there is an interesting kind of range within that, within the possible choices. And what's really interesting is that, and then how these things get combined and used to really push the case forward. So Article 59 of the Code Noir is the key one for free people of color, not the only one, but it is the major one. And so then on the part of the slave insurgencies, the operative provisions are those banning the torture and brutalization of slaves. And there are only about, I would say, four documents, I think, something like four, one of which may be a forgery, but I don't think is. But the case has been made that it is likely a forgery. But in any case, there are three other documents. These are letters between the leaders of the insurgent camps in 1791-92 to the first civil commission sent by the French legislature to resolve the so-called troubles of Saint-Domingue. And one of the arguments that's made in those letters is that, we are seeking to end a long trail of abuses, so to speak, in the administration of slavery. And we're not going to put down our weapons until this kind of stuff ends. Now, it turns out to be a really complicated problem because what is the objective of the slave insurgent camps at this time? Is it simply to end brutalization on the plantations, or is it something more than that? I think it is clearly more than that. I think more than that is the correct answer to that question. But in arguing for the more than that, there is this attention paid to kind of the interim problem, if you will, of the disciplining of slaves. And I think, you can understand what the context is here. I mean, these slave insurgent camps are not expecting an immediate end to slavery that has been, in existence for more than 100 years, right? So the idea that we're just going to wake up tomorrow and be free people, I think that's not part of their vision. And because it's not part of their vision, they have to think about what a new plantation order, a reform plantation order, will look like. And it's not just them, the slave insurgencies. The representatives who are sent from France, Santonex and Polverel, in the later civil commissions, they have to enact a version of reform that will include a new plantation order. And in fact, they actually adopt wholesale many of these earlier provisions of the Code Noir into their ordinances, their plantation management ordinances. That process eventually becomes what we call abolition, which is a bit of a misnomer. Because what you're really talking about is a process of reforming the plantation order that eventually will include, yes, a wholesale, full-scale manumission of the slave communities of Saint-Domingue. And it's something that's undertaken in a context of military rivalry between Britain, France, and Spain for control of the territory of Saint-Domingue. And in that sense, it's part of a search for manpower. But it is also a process that reflects this sense that, well, what we're looking at is not, again, a state of unmitigated freedom, but rather some new version of the plantation complex in which there will be greater autonomy for the slaves. There will be a lessened role for plantation owners. Many of them have fled the colony, but not all of them have at this point. And many of them are looking to return still to Saint-Domingue. They have the hope that their exile in Philadelphia, New Orleans, or Charleston is only temporary, and that France will succeed in bringing things under control. So that's, I think that's the context in which what we call abolition unfolds in Saint-Domingue. And you know, it's not an invalid term, but it's, I don't think it's what we, you know, commonly associate with what with abolition. All that's to say, the process of ending slavery, I think, bears a great deal of relationship with the nature of the institution that was being abolished, is the way that I like to put it. So you want to understand abolition, you have to understand the thing that is being abolished, and therefore you have to understand how slavery was defined at the time. It was defined as a set of restrictions on what planters can do, and in a sense, abolition then becomes a way of loosening certain restrictions and keeping in place others. And I think that's what freedom looks like in Saint-Domingue in the 17, from an administrative point of view, in the 1790s.
And you sort of stop, I mean, you do a little bit of talking about how the revolution unfolds and how it eventually becomes this desire for full-scale emancipation, but you're really just concerned with kind of showing this continuity across, again, the 17th and the 18th centuries. And I think that's one of the things that I found really exciting about the book is, you know, if you're not an expert in the details of the Haitian Revolution, which is a very complicated series of events, you just sort of know, okay, well, enslaved people rise up because they don't like their slavery and they try to take back their freedom. And what you're really showing is in some ways how measured that process was, especially in the early months and in the first couple of years, really. And it unfolds out of this long durée of having a sense of the law, having a sense of what that relationship between master and slave is supposed to be like. And it gives, in some ways, a much stronger agency to what the insurgents were trying to do in a certain way. It wasn't just this kind of blind rage. Right. It really had a very measured political aspect to it.
I think that's well put, Dan. In fact, if I were rewriting the book now, I would use that formulation that you just used right there. I like that a lot. Yeah, and I think it is a way of recovering a more complex sense of agency, or at least a sense that violence was not the only means of the revolution. You know, so that in addition to trying to show that the revolutionary period is not the only period relevant to understanding this long process of emancipation from slavery, it's also about showing, you know, what are I wouldn't use the term nonviolent, but I would use the phrase perhaps means other than violence that were used and law, you know, which we associate as kind of the opposite of violence, but in this context is really very, very closely connected to the methods of violence in Saint-Domingue, I think is an important factor in how the abolition process unfolds. It's probably an important factor at all times, but certainly in this context right here. And that, I think that's another way of in which, in a sense, this moral economy of slavery comes to bear on the Haitian revolutionary process. So I think, you know, if you want to kind of talk about this in terms of the methods of legal history, I think the lesson here is that it's not really about the doctrinal legacies of the law of slavery, but rather it is about how an imagined version of what the law of slavery represents can come to inform a process by which slavery is overcome, is abolished. And there, I think the Haitian Revolution poses a great example. It is a great example of how you can take a text like the Code Noir, which in so many ways is designed to shut off opportunities for disenfranchised persons, and you can manipulate the outer edges of that text. And you can use it not just by itself, because things have to happen in order for you to use this document. And things do happen. Slaves do rise up. I mean, they physically stand up, they rise up, and they revolt. That's indispensable. You don't get the end of slavery in Saint-Domingue without that happening. But I think you also don't get the Haitian Revolution without the law of slavery in Saint-Domingue. It's just, it would be a different revolution. And it could have been a different revolution. That's true. And it could have had a different outcome for Saint-Domingue. But the Haitian Revolution that we got is a revolution in which it looks like the law of slavery played this role. as I say, there are other factors that came into play. And even within the law of slavery, there are other traditions that were invoked and that were important. And one in particular would be the law of property as reflected in the Code Noir. So there are a number of articles that govern this, and that, you know, that's clearly an important part of the law of slavery. It's sort of, I think, what we think of when we think of slavery. We think of the ownership of persons as property. And, you know, as I say, you could pursue a whole other approach to this problem by looking at the property dimensions of the Code Noir. I think I address those mostly indirectly because I think they're implicit in the criminal law cases. They're implicit in the manumission cases as well. But it certainly is a theme that one would want to explore when thinking about, you know, how slavery comes to be undone. At what point do people really stop thinking of other people as property? Is an interesting question, if indeed they ever did in the first place. But at what point does the property rule actually come to an end? And I think in the case of France and Saint-Domingue, technically it's not until the 1820s with the recognition of Haitian independence. But even then, the condition of Haitian independence is that Haiti pay an indemnity to the former slave owners, right? So that reflects, I guess, an idea that, you know, we still see you as property, and if you can satisfy our property claims, well, at that point, then we will acknowledge your independence. So, you know, I think in a sense, the Code Noir is still at work in the 1820s, if you will. Because that was a major claim of planters throughout the 18th century, that the Code Noir makes you property, and if you're going to have a revolution, fine, but at least indemnify us for our property claims. So I think, you know, I think it's an interesting question whether or not this property claim was ever really surrendered, and at what point really begin to fail. I'm not sure. I think that's one of the great questions of kind of modern race relations, you know. But in any case, it's certainly an important one in Haiti's context.
Well, and that's maybe a good place to get our conversation wrapped up here. I hope I'm not really missing anything. There's such a lot of great detail in here. And as someone who does a little bit of legal work in my own research, I just found it so fascinating. But I'm wondering if there are any new projects you're pursuing right now after kind of being a couple of years past the book.
Yeah, no, I am. I better have, is one way of putting that. But I am hard at work right now on a new book, which actually does start in Saint-Domingue, although it doesn't end there. But it's a new book about the French and the British East India companies in the 18th century. And it's about conflicts over the monopoly authority of these large Indies trading companies. And the first such revolt that I look at, it unfolds in Saint-Domingue in the early 1720s, in the years after the Mississippi bubble crashes. There is a revolt in Saint-Domingue that really helps to begin to put an end to the French Indies Company in the Atlantic world. And afterwards, they turn to India. And that's part one. The second part has to do with the British East India Company and the American Tea Crisis, you know, a revolt that's famous to us in these here parts. And then the third section is about the French Revolutionary crackdown on the monopoly authority of the French Indies Company. So that's a story from 1789 to about 1794. So it's still an Atlantic project. It begins in Saint-Domingue, but it doesn't end there. Although there's an interesting Haitian connection at the end, which I think will go into my postscript, which is about the role of the Haitian Revolution in the British East India Company's expansion at the end of the 18th century. So it turns out that as a result of the Haitian Revolution, the global indigo industry kind of migrates from the Caribbean, where it was rooted in Saint-Domingue, to Bengal in India. And the British East India Company really spearheads this reorientation, and they're taking advantage of the vacuum that the Haitian Revolution created. And so indigo goes to India, and from there it remains until the end of the 19th century. I'm really kind of more interested these days, increasingly interested in sort of these, what we now call the two Indies, or the relationship between the two Indies, but the Caribbean and the East Indies. But there's an example of that relationship. So that's what I'm doing now.
Well, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to reading about that. And this book, I think, for anyone that's interested at all in kind of slave history, it's such a great kind of refreshing look at a part of the history we don't tend to look at that often, and sort of how the law interacts with these questions of slavery. So thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it too. Thank you so much, Dan.
All right. Bye-bye.